culture bearer. Drawing inspiration from childhood memories and ancestral roots, Pono's art explores themes of alternate worlds, the extension of family lineage beyond this sphere, and the significance of recovering and honoring one's history and identity, pulling on inspiration from systematic barriers around us and how the disruption of colonialism affects the passage of knowledge. Pono takes us on a journey through their creative process and a whole lot more. This episode originally aired on September 5th, 2024. Enjoy.
The worlds that I create in my art are kind of explorations of what it could mean if other worlds exist. If our lineages extend past this world and kind of extend to other worlds, what would it mean to try to recover family history and family knowledge?
Bonjour, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lam. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show at its core. It's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds, musicians, artists, doctors, educators, language warriors, you name it. We talk to them. We talk to our guests about what they do, about their gifts, and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And I can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices today. How are you doing, Cole?
Doing great, you know. We're in the final phase of summer here, so trying to enjoy it as much as possible. Planning on going canoeing, an overnight canoe trip, but I have to navigate the weather forecast to make sure we don't get rained on. You know, I'm enjoying life. How are you doing, Leah?
I'm doing pretty good. I think this time of year is always so nostalgic for me, you know, with the start of a school year and just knowing that time is just flying by. You know, it just kind of marks another time of year for me. I feel like this time of year for me is a new year. Like January 1st for me isn't a new year. It's just the same old, but this time it just feels different.
Maybe it's because your birthday is just come and gone. Happy belated.
That's true. Thank you.
So excited for that.
No, it's a good one. Double the drinking age, right?
Sheesh. Nah, you wear it well, Leah. You wear it well.
Yeah, thank you. I had people ask me like, oh, is this a big birthday or what birthday is this for you? I'm like, double the drinking age, I guess.
Jeez. No, that's good. But yeah, so, this summer's gone by so quick. It's kind of crazy to say that every year. But
I know.
Just, come on. It seemed like it just started, like June was just underway and now here we are at the end of August.
Yeah.
Just like that.
But I'm really excited. Today we're going to be speaking with Pono Assumption.
Yeah.
Pono uses Z, they pronouns and is a self and community taught multimedia and disciplinary maker, storyteller, illustrator, and culture bearer. Really wonderful art. So, you know, I'm in Grand Rapids and the McCroskey Arts Center is just down the road from me. And these past couple months, Pono's work has been at the McCroskey. That is ending here, but their artwork is so magical. I don't really know how to describe it so much, so maybe they'll do a much better job than I will, but it just reminds me of something that you might only see in a dream, vivid colors. So I'm really excited to talk to them about their work and, you know, how their work fits in with their life and, yeah, all of that good stuff. So let's welcome Pono Assumption.
Hello.
Hey, Buju, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good.
All right, Buju, Pono, could you please start out by, you know, introducing yourself and just telling us where you're joining us from, a little bit of background, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah, so my name is Pono. My pronouns are Z and they. And I am based in Bedeota Otunwe, or known as Minneapolis, off the shores of Wiratopa and Bede Makaska. So a really beautiful place to be. And I kind of committed to an art practice and learning and self-teaching and kind of trying to share my ideas maybe like 3 years ago now. Been creating my whole life, but I kind of marked that as when I believed that I could be like a capital A artist, as I thought of it. And yeah, my day job, I'm an arts administrator. I work at the McKnight Foundation as a program administrator for the arts and culture team and for the neuroscience teams. Two very different fields, but very fun. Support the teams over there for their scheduling and meetings and stuff. Yeah, and I make a lot of stuff, and I kind of can't do anything but think about making or make or talk about it.
You make stuff. I like it. All right, we like to follow that up with, you know, how are you doing? How's the family doing?
Good. Yeah, thanks for asking. They're kind of all over the place. So I have family in Minnesota, in Rochester, in Northfield. I've got some nieces down there. They're good. I've got a lot of nibblings. They're mostly younger than me. Some of them are older than me, but we all grew up together and we're kind of in a stage where we're all becoming adults and some of us are actually having kids. So I have great nibblings. And so it's been really cool to connect with them as like our fully cooked human selves and be like, oh yeah, let's compare notes. They're all finding their ways. There's a lot of them. My brother has 7 kids and one of my sisters has 2 and another sister has 3. So when you ask how a family is, I'm like, okay, which cohort? Some of my family is living in Hawaii. My brother is a graphic designer out there. He's living with my mom and his fiance. It's kind of all between Minnesota, Hawaii, and California. And then, yeah, some family I haven't met yet in Puerto Rico and the Philippines and probably other places. Mostly overall, we are finding our ways. We are chugging along, being messy, complicated, beautiful people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see from your bio that you have a family member that's not a human, but a dog.
I do.
Can you tell me about your dog?
Oh my gosh, yes. So we got him in 8th grade, or I got him in 8th grade. So for context, I'm 27 now. I'm about to be 28. So he just turned 14. Got him as a kid. Everything that I've trained him to do, it's really reflective of that time of my life. So he only knows how to like roll over and talk and speak, but not coming and staying, those sorts of things. I didn't get to live with him full time until a few years ago, and he was being fostered for a bit, and now we have him back, and he's just living a beautiful, retired, nap-filled life. He just wakes up from one nap to go to another nap spot.
What's his name?
Kumu. I also picked that in 8th grade. I had my dad's Hawaiian dictionary, and I saw that one of the meanings of Kumu is handsome. So I was like, yes, that. I didn't see that it also can mean fish woman or fishmonger, but also teacher. If you've heard of Kumuhina, she's a Kanaka teacher. So Kumu in the handsome way, but I guess he's a handsome teacher fish woman.
Well, Pono, we like to make sure to ask, you know, is there anything that's on the top of your mind these days?
Yeah. Transitions. This is the first year that I'm kind of not absolutely devastated that it's August and it's going to be fall soon. Like I've kind of been having more grace for like the cyclical way that Minnesota moves through time and like how that's a nice marker of time. I'm also thinking a lot about visibility in a lot of different ways. I think I'm in a place where a lot of the identities I hold can be very confusing to a lot of people and not necessarily be readily understood.
Are there aspects of your identity that you want to make sure to get across for people?
It's important for me to communicate about my neurodivergent identity. For me, that means like autism and ADHD and kind of how that informs how I find community, how I relate with and to people, how I find solidarity. And the visibility piece goes along with that because, you know, in the media, in just the general consciousness of, you know, the society that I live in and that we live in is that these things show up a very particular way and usually only in young white cisgender boys. And I'm none of those things. And so those things show up very differently for me. Of course, I'm Indigenous. I have lots of different Indigenous lineages. And that's something that I'm learning more about and learning more about the specificities of, so that I can say, like, yes, I'm Indigenous and I'm Taino, or I'm Ilocano, I'm Kanaka. And of course, queerness, transness. I was born with an F on my birth certificate, and that means I move through the world in a certain way.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Pono Assuncion, an interdisciplinary artist, storyteller, illustrator, and culture bearer.
Well, you mentioned becoming a capital A artist. Was there like an event or like a realization that you had when that became true? Like, could you talk about just becoming that artist?
I tend to unconsciously build up toward big decisions in my life and then impulsively make the declaration that I'm going to do whatever thing that I've been unconsciously building toward. That's kind of how it happened. I was bringing up laundry in our apartment basement, and I was like, you know what? I want to be an artist. And I didn't know really what that meant to me. It means I want to make a lot of things and I want to share with people. I came upstairs from the basement and said to my partner, Miriam, I want to be an artist. And she was like, cool, you can do that. And I went, yeah, I can do that. Okay. The community org that I worked for had an extra iPad, and I had some ideas for like some mutual aid projects that I could contribute art to. So I was learning digital art, and then my partner Miriam and I were also talking about writing and illustrating a children's book together. I was like, well, if I'm going to try to illustrate a book, I want to learn some more about illustration and actually commit to like learning the things that I want to learn. And those things all kind of mashed together. They all happened within the same week or months. It happened over time, but that's kind of what I remember.
Well, Pono, I was thinking, I'm up here in Grand Rapids, right next to the McCroskey Art Center. Your work was showing there. It's so imaginative, vibrant. Can you tell me a bit about that exhibit?
Yeah, it's still kind of surreal to know that my art is up in a central community hub that people pass through a lot. So in a community of people I didn't know, and just being known as Pono, the person who made the weird stuff on the walls, that was really, really special, because I got to connect with a lot of people who were either artists themselves or who connected in some way to something that I said in the artist remarks. It was also really cool to be in a space that really feels like it supports and centers Native makers and artists.
Yeah, it's a great crew at the McCroskey Art Center. And Grand Rapids is just this lovely city that's supportive of artists.
We stayed over at an Airbnb close by and took like a little adventure. And so actually got to like see and experience the town and community. That felt important too, to not come in and then drop off my stuff and leave and not sort of understand literal physical place where I was. So,
can you say more then about your artwork? I want to hear how you describe your art style and your approach.
I think about like kind of how silly it is. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty silly, isn't it? And whimsy and silliness help us see the absurdity in everything, including like systems of power and the absurdity inherent in white supremacy and capitalism. And if we can like use whimsy and silliness to critique that, I feel like it's a more sustainable way of going about critique and asking for change.
Pono, how would you describe what your artwork looks like and what medium you use?
I want to talk about institutions and power and home and grief and diaspora all in a really indirect way. Yeah, the worlds that I create in my art are kind of explorations of what it could mean if other worlds exist, if our lineages extend past this world and kind of extend to other worlds. What would it mean to try to recover family history and family knowledge? So I like to apply sort of a sci-fi lens to these questions of indigeneity and grief. It's also sort of my way of trying to transform grief from this thing I only understand through absence of my father who passed when I was two, his mother who passed more recently, the knowledge that they held, the knowledge that people before them held, if that can't be physically passed down, how can I, how did my ancestors, how will, like, the people who call me ancestor, how do we use our creativity to make grief a more generative force, and a force where we can imagine an event memory and knowledge for ourselves in a way that still helps us understand ourselves, our place in community, in the world, in our families, in a way that is connected and not disconnected from our indigeneity, even if the people we would look to as culture bearers are no longer around. And connect that with really, really loving comics and graphic novels as a kid, and still loving making those, and animated sci-fi shows and that sort of thing. And you get sort of the strange creatures, the invented languages, the sigils, they all kind of exist within this decision to believe that I'm adding to this sort of intergenerational archive and library of knowledge, even if I don't quite understand what that knowledge is.
That's so valid. And, you know, even exploring in the process of thinking through things is valid.
Yes, yes. You asked me originally how I would describe my work, right? It's funny because I've got to remember what I put together for this exhibit, because I go all over the place. But what I had at that exhibit was a combination of watercolor, acrylic, ink, marker, paint marker, paintings, and definitely graphite and colored pencil. Office supplies like highlighters and tape and cardboard. I had a lot of smaller pieces that I actually constructed into collaged pieces in a frenzy about 2 weeks before the exhibit, because I was still figuring out framing and how everything was going to go together, and it was going to be easier to to frame if I had bigger and less pieces. So I was like, great, I've got all of these little pieces that I've been gathering and storing away. Let me assemble them into a story that I want to tell. A lot of bright colors. I think a lot of playing with light and shadow. I like to explore rock formations. I like to explore the making of rock formations. And I like how you can depict them in a really atmospheric way that really gives you a sense of place. I think I have a lot of graphic qualities to my work. I have a lot of intricate line work. I don't think any of these kinds of pieces were in my exhibit, but I do a lot of black and white ink drawing. There was an animated piece in the exhibit, about a minute and a half long, called Decrypt. That was a digital animation that I made on my iPad. So a lot of the pieces in that were digital paintings that I made with a stylus on an iPad. But any medium that I can get my hands on, and now that it's been a few years, I kind of have an art supply store in my shelves. I'm trying not to add more to it. I like layering. So you'll see a lot of layers and color and like a lot of energetic brush strokes. But I am excited to exhibit more of my drawings, because they tend to take a more, or just a different approach to image making. And it's a bit more precise. And yeah, my black and white ink drawings get kind of strange. They get into more comics and narrative and character. So I am excited to find some way to share those with people too. But a lot of landscape paintings and a lot of non-landscapey colors or non-earth landscapey colors, and mostly done from imagination.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Pono Asuncion, an interdisciplinary artist, storyteller, illustrator, and culture bearer.
I'm always curious, like, how does the process go for you? Is it something like you're inspired by something that just pops into your head? Is there some times where you just, you know, like, what you want to do and you set out to do it? Is it different every time?
I think very rarely, it has happened, I'll get like kind of a specific image in my head that I want to try to recreate. But often it's kind of like self-administrated like Rorschach test. Some mediums though that might be a pencil, and I'll sit down and just start drawing shapes, start drawing different lines, start basically doodling. Like I try to take a doodling approach to making, because I'm usually often inspired by tangible feeling of being like, ooh, like it would be nice kind of brain scratching to like paint with a paintbrush today, or like, ooh, I want to make this thing on my iPad and explore how these colors interact. So I found a lot of the time that it's visual experiments that often prompts me to make. I don't know. We've all got, I guess, internal monologues in our heads. And my oldest brother talks a lot about, he's always like, oh yeah, I was just chatting with dad the other day. I've been thinking about that a lot and trying to imagine like what that would be like for me. And so sometimes I am like imagining, you know, a conversation that I'd be having with my dad or my grandmother. And that'll sometimes spur me to make a painting. Yeah. Or it'll be an actual idea that I have for an illustration or a series. But what often ends up getting made is the more spontaneous, I just want to doodle moments. And I've got lots of ideas written down, and I'm still trying to figure out how to execute the ones that like I want to plan just a little bit. So it's often spontaneous, often just because I feel like I need to meditate somehow, or to just like kind of let my nervous system have a break. And that's often where I end up with pieces that I'm really excited about and want to share with people.
I hate to make you choose, but is there like one piece that you're particularly fond of and like, you know, you just hit it out of the park kind of, you know?
Oh, honestly, when you said that, I did think of one piece. So I will say that one. It's on like a 6 by 3 foot wood panel. I call it trash wood. I found some wood in my alley behind the cottage where we live. I primed it, I painted on it, and I didn't really know what I was going to paint, but I ended up with like very wise, strange looking turtle with like a stack of shells on rocks and shells on its own shell, and it's kind of underwater. I titled it Diving for Shells, kind of thinking about it as like this composite memory that I have of diving in Hawaii with my brothers and looking at the like the seashells that are on the seafloor. It's really fun to hear how other people refer to it, because some people think it's like a sea otter or like, you know, something else. And they're like, so is it this? And I'm like, yeah, if you want it to be, yeah. It's a lot of layers. It's a lot of my favorite colors. Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually at Indigenous Roots now in St. Paul. It's in the library if you want to go see it.
There you go, listener. Go check it out.
Yeah.
We have to ask, because in our, you know, with our podcast, we love to explore like what brought you to where you are now? Like what inspired you to do, you know, become that capital A artist? Like what led you on that road?
Yeah. I think I want to be clear. How I think of capital A artist is just like being like, oh yeah, I'm going to call myself an artist. So just like for anybody out there, I'm like, there's no, I'm not saying there's any like criteria for you to call yourself a capital A artist. That's just like, you know, the moment that you decide you're going to be, that's all you like. Great. But
there's an online form.
Yeah.
That you got.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like before the laundry moment, before, you know, all of that, like what inspired you to do these doodles, to do the art, to do the painting, to get it all going?
Wow, a lot of things. I think earliest it was seeing my siblings and a lot of the time my brother draw and make things. And I went, oh, you can like do that. I also want to do that, it turns out. And he got it really into graffiti and like characters. And so I would copy a lot of the things that he did. And then I got really into typography when I was in middle school. And so I'd copy a lot of like fonts
and make gifts for friends. So that was a lot of like what inspired me before, was like trying to figure out kind of the perfect, what I would understand now is like a commission. It's like, what would this person really, really love based on like all of the things I know about them? Let me produce like the most perfect piece of artwork and let me hyper focus on that for 7 hours and present it to them at school. So a lot of it was like connecting with people and connecting with people in a way that I felt like most comfortable doing so. Like I didn't have to talk or make small talk. I could just be like, hey, I made you this thing. And that could be a way that I could connect with people even while navigating social situations was hard. And then later during COVID, actually, I got really into video games and especially the Zelda Breath of the Wild game. And I got really into environment design and landscapes. And so, yeah, I got a lot into, you know, landscape painting. And I think still, yeah, different landscapes anywhere in Minnesota or imagined in my brain. I really like painting because, the world building process is really inspiring to me.
Awesome. I always love video game references. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got a Kurok on my arm. I don't know. You can't quite see it, but it's right there. It's a little Kurok. He's hanging by his leaf. Yeah. Yeah. I had to commemorate that. Took up a lot of good time.
Looks great. All right. Well, man, we could just keep going on and on, but I really, really appreciate you sharing, you know, all this. I know that there's so much more to talk about, to dive into, but, you know, we always like to ask, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to mention, things that we haven't brought up?
No, I think I'll just use the last 2 minutes to just thank you guys for inviting me on. Like, I'm really honored to be able to share in this way. It feels very special. You know, I feel bad that I didn't ask as many questions of you guys because I'm so curious. So, but thank you.
All right. That's the interview. All right. What'd you think, Cole?
Yeah. I fully, you know, encourage those listening to check Pono's workout because it's just, it's hard to describe, like you said, but it feels right when you're looking at it. And it's very fantastical. The colors, each painting is just so completely different than the next. So really glad that we took some time and checked in with Pono.
That's right. And we'll make sure to have their work linked on the Native Lights episode.
So miigwech to Pono Assumption. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening.
Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Now, to me, that sounds more like a submarine than an animal. That sounds like radar going off.
Doesn't sound like a truck backing up?
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah. But you know what it is?
If I had to guess.
Yeah.
An owl?
A sowhet owl.
Oh.
W-H-E-T.
See, I would not be able to tell you different, like, specific owl calls.
Okay. Because we also have, I was thinking we were going to listen to on the Season Watch pod. I forgot sowhet is like the truck backing up. It is the barred owl that is the one that sounds like who cooks for you.
Mm.
Which, I mean, what a phrase is that? You can't forget it, you know? It's one of those sort of mnemonic devices.
Oh.
It sounds like a dog, too.
Yeah, it does sound like a dog barking.
Who cooks for you? That's Andrew Dzingo. I'm Heidi Holton, and this is the Season Watch podcast. It is a place for those who are curious. It is filled with the delights of nature. I would say I'm usually just the curious one. I don't know all about the delights of nature, so that's why I've called you in, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm a longtime listener, first-time co-host. And before people get too worried, like, I know Charlie Mitchell knows so much and knows a lot of facts. So I thought I needed to come in to this program with my own facts.
Uh-oh.
So I looked up interesting facts about blue jays, my favorite bird.
Oh.
So anytime you need an interesting fact added to the conversation, I've got five ready to go anytime.
Wow. Why do you like blue jays?
Because they're blue and blue is my favorite color.
Okay.
And I just saw one last week during Thanksgiving dinner. A blue jay showed up.
They stick around.
Yep.
They don't go anywhere. And they have a very distinctive call. Okay, I'm ready for a fact.
Okay, first fact. Did you know blue jays rub ants on their feathers before they eat them, draining them of their formic acid? It's called anting.
I did know that. No, I'm just kidding. I did not know that. Of course I didn't know that. Wow.
So I wonder how they do that. Like, because you would think that ants are so, I don't know, crushable. That'd be hard to keep them from your beak and rub them quick.
Yeah. You just did right there what happens every week on the Season Watch Pod, where we sort of answer a question, but that leads to more questions.
Absolutely.
You know, I wonder why they do that. Huh. So we're going to be hearing in this next half hour from, of course, our esteemed phenologist, John Latimer. He's talking about winter and what we can be seeing out there. Because I think I'm getting better because of spending time with John Latimer and listening to him on the radio. I used to think like nothing was going on in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And then one time he told me, he goes, look at the snow. See those little flecks? Those are snow fleas. I'm like, what? It just looks like gravy to me with little flecks of pepper. But it's a different time of year when the snow is on the ground. Same as for like deer hunting. It's better if they have snow so you can track them.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our, we're going to hear from some kids from Little Falls today. They are figuring that out too, that this is the time of year that we get to be little Columbos, nature Columbo.
And just one more thing.
Oh, fun fact, Andrew used to do a podcast about Columbo. But yep. Anyway, that
Pod Lumbo.
But Season Watch Pod today. So we're going to take a listen to a portion of the phenology report with John Latimer here.
Winter, December is also the season for owls to be coming down from up north, or just to be coming out and being more visible. Part of that is the fact that we only have 8 hours of daylight. We have 16 hours of darkness. So the owls have much more time to get out and get around. This time of year, northern hawk owls, snowy owls, great gray owls, boreal owls, barred owls, great horned owls, all will be coming out. And throw in rough-legged hawks and pine grosbeaks and evening grosbeaks and shrikes, and you've got a pretty good list of birds that you're going to see only in the winter in this area. Insects, snow fleas, scorpion flies, there'll be some spiders out walking around on the surface of the snow. This is also the season where you will see or smell a skunk. The last ones maybe just getting ready for bed, and somebody upsets them and they spray, and then you know that the skunk has been out. It'll be mid-February when we start seeing the male skunks emerge and begin to try to find females.
So, yeah, I didn't think about that until he mentioned it, that, like, for owls, this is prime time of year. They've got as much darkness as possible
mm-hmm.
for them to go hunting all night long.
Right. And we have such little light that we do have more opportunity to be seeing them at dusk, because we're probably out more often
mm-hmm.
at dusk earlier than at, you know, summertime dusk, if that makes sense, looking for them.
Mm-hmm. And I always get a thrill whenever I see an owl. It feels like a very special moment.
Yeah, for sure. But see, there's all these we think of as like birds go south. At least I do.
Mm-hmm.
But we have special birds that we are south to them. They're coming here.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. I mean, have you ever paid attention to the insects in winter before?
No, I never. I just noticed the insects that come into my apartment because it's cold outside.
Right. He recently was talking about a mosquito that was in his house this week. but he thinks it's because of he heats with wood, that they were somehow
On the wood.
Yeah, the pieces of wood is why it came into the house. But, you know, I mean, all this stuff of like what animals, what amphibians are doing in the wintertime. A recent Season Watch podcast was about frogsicles.
Yes, I was listening to that episode talking about just like they basically stop their hearts.
Yeah.
It just like goes like once in a very long time.
Yeah. And they're, it becomes like they have internal antifreeze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, isn't that just, there's something about that that is so amazing.
I wonder, do like, when they hibernate, are they dreaming the whole time or is it just a state of nothingness? I don't know.
We're missing Charlie Mitchell this week because I did pose a few weeks back. She would love this when you do this anthropomorphize thing of like thinking that an animal thinks just like we do,
mm-hmm.
you know, or put human qualities onto the natural world. That's what you're doing, because I had talked about a cousin of mine who asked me if bugs, do they think that we're big bugs or do they know that we're people?
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of saying that too, of like, what are they thinking? Are they dreaming?
Yeah, because I recently heard that cats understand that we are creatures that are big enough to like squish them if we wanted to, but they know we don't, so they just tolerate hanging out with us.
Huh. Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, talking and learning about some of this stuff does remind me to be kind of looking a little bit more, looking a little closely, because it, you know, winter can be hard and you don't always want to get outside. And but there are still things to be kind of focusing on and looking at.
Yeah, I think it's really cool when you like go cross country skiing and you come across animal tracks that
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't know came across the same path you did if you didn't have snow there for them to make fresh tracks on or whatever.
So, Andrew, we're going to listen to the kids from the middle school in Little Falls. This is Chad Kaditz's class, and they do amazing things there, including he is an artist, Chad Kaditz, and so we get to see his drawing. He does drawings of the phenology on the chalkboard.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so he sends those in to us, and that'll be available through the podcast too, where you can see that. But were you a kid that was noticing nature?
I would, when I was on the bus ride and didn't have a Game Boy, I didn't really have anything. So I would just look out the window the whole time.
Yeah.
So it was always cool just seeing the different animals out there. I remember seeing like a little baby rabbit out in the like, freshly harvested fields around mm-hmm. my house, because I lived in farm country. So I would notice stuff like that on the bus all the time.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous, and I absolutely love hearing from the kids each week on Phenology on Tuesday mornings on KEXE, because first of all, just hearing their voices, but then, you know, what they teach us, but then it kind of moves into a little bit of envy, because I wish I'd had that kind of connection when I was a kid.
Yeah, I wish I would have been encouraged more as a child to look out for nature stuff.
Let's take a listen to Little Falls.
This is Brietta.
And Peyton.
Reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report for the week of November 30th.
Prior to the snow, we had sightings of a woolly bear, caterpillar, and sow bugs. And a classmate still found violets blooming in their yard.
We did see small groups of robins hanging around Little Falls.
Mr. Kaditz had an opossum snooping around his yard and under his bird feeder after sundown, and had a hard time getting it to leave as he didn't want his dog messing with it.
Winter arrived as we received 7+ inches of snow on the 25th, and the snow and cold weather have completely changed our environment.
One fun change with the new snow is the ability to see all the different animal tracks around our homes. The most common are the cottontail rabbits, squirrels, mice, and voles.
Those same deer, mice, and meadow voles have been appearing in our homes more frequently this past week.
The bird feeders have had a constant activity with groups of chickadees, nuthatches, downy woodpeckers, and juncos being the largest visitors.
There was a large group of cedar waxwings that arrived on Thanksgiving Day.
There was a sighting of a short-tailed shrew. It was originally thought to be a vole, but a closer look at the pictures helped identify it.
An easy sighting this time of year are some fruits of the sumac. We learned that you can make a drink similar to lemonade from it.
One observation that raised some questions was this. All fall, there have been pairs or family groups of cardinals coming to Mr. Kaditz's feeder. This past week, there has only been a single female. Do they split up in winter? Is this a young bird? Did something happen to the male it was with?
This is our report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
So for me, voles are always the animal I think of. Whenever there's like little tracks on the snow, I like feel like I was always told, oh, it's probably a vole. It's always a vole. I've never seen a vole, but everyone always tells me that, oh, yeah, it's vole tracks. Like, how do they know?
Yeah. And voles are same family as mice, I think. Boy, we could use Charlie Mitchell. But we know we're asking
I have a Blue
questions.
Jay fact if you're ready.
Oh, yeah. Actually, we will get to that. But yeah, these, I mean, hearing these kids and how much they're paying attention and that they already know there's still things to see in winter and pointing out the drastic difference in seasons changing for them this week. Anyway, yes, I would like the Blue Jay fact number two from you, Andrew.
Okay, Blue Jay fact number two. Now, did you know that Blue Jay feathers are not actually blue? They're actually brown, which I would have thought they were gray because they kind of look gray when it's like a cloudy day.
Yeah.
But the reason they're changing colors is refraction on the feathers.
You're bringing science into this, aren't you?
Yeah.
We're communicating with people in a little bit different way. We're using SpeakPipe, and we also had a message this week that has to do with some of the same stuff we're talking about of paying attention and being the nature Columbos out there. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Heidi and Charlie. Thanks so much for your podcast. I really enjoy it. I was up for a walk this morning in the new fallen snow and saw what I thought was the single register track from a fox, but the paw prints were quite large, and it made me wonder if there's another animal that has a single register track that's not a fox, that's bigger than a fox. So love to hear your thoughts about that, and just love your show in general. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you, Julie, and thanks for your compliments on the show. I owe that all to Heidi and Charlie. They're the ones doing the work there. Well, the thing about the single track that she's talking about, if you look at a fox track, they lay their tracks down one after another. It's like a long dotted line, and they don't wander very much. They pick a direction and they go. And it's because they're interested in eating and finding more food. And so unlike the dog that gets its chow from you, the fox and probably in this case it might have been a coyote. That would be my next guess up the chain. If the paw prints were too large for a fox, and a fox's paw print is going to be, oh, maybe an inch and a half to 2 inches on the long axis. Otherwise, you know, if it's wider or longer than that, it's probably a coyote. But sometimes some of us just have big feet. So maybe it was a fox with big feet. I can't tell you without having looked at it. I will tell you this, if you find a canid print, a dog print in the snow, you're going to see an X. The two middle toes kind of hang together, and then there's a gap between the two outside toes. You get a sort of an X in the middle of the paw print. And if it is a coyote or a fox, it will not have the same sharp, deeply imprinted toenails that a dog will have. And the reason for that is these animals are moving all the time, and they just wear their toenails down, digging, hunting, traveling. Your dog is not doing that. It's not traveling, it's not digging, and it's not hunting for food every day. And so the dog tracks tend to have longer, sharper claw prints. But that's a pretty subtle difference.
We'd love to hear from you, too. You can leave us a voice memo. Find it in the notes of the podcast or at our website, kaxc.org.
Do we want another blue jay fact?
Yes, please, lay it on me.
All right. Did you know blue jays can mimic the sounds of a hawk? Now, scientists aren't sure why exactly they do it. They're not sure if it's because they use it to warn fellow blue jays about hawks are in the area, or they're doing it to scare off other birds so that they can, like, get food and stuff like that.
Another thing that came up this week, Andrew, I wanted to talk to you about, and I hope you'll be open-minded on this, has to do with how we report the weather.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, when we were on the air together on Wednesday, you were reporting on, you know, on Wednesday that evening was going to be probably our first below zero weather.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you called it?
No, what I said is that it was going to be a low of -9, which caused some controversy of how to describe temperatures that get below zero.
Yes. So we heard from Tim in Maple Grove about this. Are you ready for it?
Yep.
When traditional winter temps are reported, people will say -8 degrees, for example. They could have said 8 below or -8. Seems to me that -8 is not accurate. The temp didn't change dramatically from normal, so like a zero, mm-hmm. to a -1 or a 1 below. He's saying when you say -1, that seems drastically different than saying it's 0 degrees out. He said it should not have that negative temperature when reporting in Fahrenheit. Below zero or minus are accurate, but not negative. That seems to assign a subjective evaluation to the temperature. Because he said for Celsius, it is a big difference, substantial change from 1 to 0, kind of like 32 degrees is in Fahrenheit, right? We know that's. So that's what he's saying. It's not a huge marker in the way it seems. So I also think he's putting a lot of emphasis on the word negative.
Yeah, maybe he just doesn't like the word negative. But here's my question. So what if it's like 40 below? Can I say negative then? Because that seems like a drastic difference from zero.
I feel like maybe you could, yeah. Then. But I don't know. How is this going to affect you as a radio guy?
Well, it's definitely going to make me self-conscious every time I say it. So I'll be like, well, Tim wouldn't like this, so I better say it right.
Tim has so much power, and he, you know, weighed in here. Dan from Minneapolis also, he thought it was an elegant way to explain it, and he said that TV weather anchors should be ashamed for saying negative.
Now, I have been a TV anchor weatherman, and I feel like that's a subjective comment saying they should feel ashamed.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of, you're getting personal attacks here on the Season Watch pod.
You know what? I didn't get into weather to be popular. I got into it for the fame and glory.
Oh my gosh. So one of the things, so we mentioned earlier about, I want to pull a little arts and culture into this nature stuff. Okay. So we talked about the antifreeze for the frogs.
Mm-hmm.
When do you remember being most interested or becoming interested in frogs, would you say?
It would probably be from the Frog and Toad books.
Mm.
I think that's probably what really ignited, because it wasn't like, I love looking at frogs, but
anthropomorphizing. Yes. I worked on that a lot before.
So. Oh my gosh. Well, frogs that look like people.
Yes. Yes.
I always am fascinated by it because they look so cute all the time.
Right. Kermit.
Kermit. That's a good example.
Yeah.
Frog and Toad.
Yes.
There was that character that was on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that was a frog guy. So, yeah, I would say it's from that. But also, I think frogs are so fascinating. They got huge fingers, toes kind of things. They can leap. They've got long tongues to get bugs.
Yeah, they really are.
And their resting face is just so funny. Of just like...
Oh my God.
And I'm not the only one. There's like ancient pictures of people drawing frogs
right.
looking funny. So
I guess what I forgot to mention was that you are a... Could we say you're a frog artist?
Yeah, I'd probably say that.
Yeah. So, you know, I know this is something that intrigues and makes Andrew curious, and that's kind of what this whole thing is really about. We also mentioned, you mentioned going cross-country skiing and looking at what's going on. So last year I made a concerted effort because I'd been in the past someone who didn't always want to be out in winter. Would think of it as just, it's book time, you know? I don't have to be outside.
Get that blanket around you?
Uh-huh. Cozy. But we started in the last couple of years cross-country skiing mostly for, as I age, for balance. A doctor told me that cross-country skiing is like really, really good because balance can be a big deal as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
And that even if he told me that that's the only reason he cross-country skis. He's not like not,
he doesn't enjoy it. It's just
it's working on his balance. I mean, he enjoys nature and stuff. But so I've already been out a few times.
Yeah, you said that, and I was jealous because I haven't had a chance to go out.
Yeah, well, it's right out my back door. It's in our woods, and Tom made a little trail for us.
See, but, yeah, that's probably my biggest hurdle is like convincing myself to load up the car, make the drive, and then put all the stuff back on, kind of thing.
Yeah,
if I can just get over that hurdle, I would.
I know. I would do the same thing. I'm very spoiled that way. But so in the Bemidji area, what are some places you've cross-country skied, or give us some ideas here?
So there's five places, I guess I have, because there's one in town in Bemidji, the Montebello track, which is in downtown Bemidji behind the curling rink. That's a good one because it has lights, so you can cross-country ski all you want at night, which is really cool. And, like, it's not very popular at night, too, so you kind of feel like you have this whole space to yourself. Otherwise, Mobile Maze, that's the one that kind of scares me the most because it seems like the toughest one, but I enjoy it. And also the one at Bemidji State Park, which I'm not sure what that situation is because of the storm that happened this summer. I'm not sure if all those trails are open right now, but that is one I go to. And then Three Island Park, which I know is DJ Dang's favorite spot to go to, just because you get to go wrap around a river.
Oh, fun.
So just having that river sound in the background all the time is super soothing and it's super relaxing. And is it forest bathing in winter?
I think so. I mean, I guess why do you think it wouldn't be forest bathing?
Just because there's no leaves, I guess.
Okay, I was going to say because you're wearing even more clothes. If you think of it as bathing.
Oh, yeah, that part.
But nobody, you know, when you say it in other seasons, nobody's nude. So that really doesn't make any sense. I mean, somebody could be. I mean, I shouldn't speak for everybody. Some people may be forest bathing nude, but that's a whole other story to get to someday.
And then my favorite spot, the final one, is Hobson, which is owned by Bemidji State University, but it's open for cross-country skiers. And it's my favorite because it's not too big, but it's big enough where you get a good workout, but if you feel like, you know what, I could do one more lap around kind of thing. It's like a huge commitment where like Three Island, once you're on the trail, it's a big commitment all the way.
Did you ski when you were a student at BSU?
Nope. I cross-country skied in like ninth grade in high school. That's when I learned. And we did it at the Old Mill State Park, which is the closest state park where I lived. And then didn't until 2019, I want to say, my friends got into cross-country skiing and they like lent me a pair of skates and did it that way. And I was like, this is fun. And then COVID happened. So I'm like, well, I really should be doing outdoor stuff. So I got cross-country skis and haven't looked back.
Nice. I have never heard of Old Mill State Park.
Oh.
What's it like?
Well, now there's not much, but there still is a standing Old Mill that you can visit, and it has audio that you can press to get like kind of the history of the space and stuff like that. But otherwise it's not a huge trail or anything, but it's got this huge like crevice where water can get to kind of thing, but there isn't much water there either.
And it's what kind of terrain? It's not a forest. Is it?
There's a bunch of trees around it.
Okay.
But I would say it's foresty.
Okay. Huh. We'd love to hear from folks. You know, Minnesota, that's one of the things that we are lucky living here in this state, the amount of state parks out there. And I know some people who make efforts to, and most of those state parks, I think, have cross-country ski trails as long as there's.
Yep, that's where I cross-country skied. That's the Old Mill State Park.
Yeah. Some people have like quests where they're getting to every single state park in the state of Minnesota.
Which I feel like Old Mill is usually one of the last ones they go to.
So we want to I think that's good you brought it up. Let's give it a little love out there. Maybe other people have been there. We'd also love to hear from you. You can leave a voice memo. Tell us about your favorite state park or favorite place to cross-country ski. How many Blue Jay?
Well, I've got two more facts.
Okay.
Do you want to hear them?
Yes, I do.
Both right now? Okay. So Did you know that blue jays are loudest in the fall? Because in the spring and summer, they're usually nesting and don't want to cause too much attention to themselves. So
sure.
Fall comes, it's open season for chanting, I guess.
Yeah.
And then finally, blue jays like to collect paint chips off houses. They think it's possibly for calcium. And if it happens to you, scientists recommend leaving out crushed eggshells for them to take instead.
Wow.
I don't know how they're getting calcium from paint chips, but I guess so.
Yeah, I feel like they would get poisoned from paint chips if it was really old, too. But, fun facts from Andrew about nature, because he's curious, and that's what this podcast is all about. We always end with a sound, and one of the birds that John Latimer was talking about that we get to see in the wintertime, it's the cedar waxwing. And to me, that the word wax in there, it almost looks like they're carved out of some sort of wax or something. They're such interesting looking birds. Have you seen them before?
I must have, but I wouldn't know from them by name.
Yeah. Well, thanks for hosting. I hope you get to do it again, and maybe with Charlie, because she'll be able to teach you more.
Yeah. Hopefully my Blue Jay facts coming in with information has not upset any listeners.
Funding for some of the audio that you heard today comes from the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, as recommended by the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Reach out to us, send a voice memo through SpeakPipe, and let's take a listen to that cedar waxwing. KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.